2 Samuel chapter 6. We have seen David crowned king of Judah at Hebron in 2 Samuel 2, 2 Samuel 5. David was crowned king over all of Israel at Hebron. Also 2 Samuel 5, David then captured Jerusalem and defeated decisively the Philistines, thus ending the Philistine threat, relatively speaking anyway, forever. Unbroken string of successes from the time of the beginning of the Civil War at the death of Saul until this defeat of the Philistines in 2 Samuel chapter 5. And so David begins to look around to see what he might do to honor the God who has made these successes possible. David does that which is typical of David. You remember when David defeated Goliath, the thing that so incited him was that the armies of the living God were being taunted. He was concerned with the glory of God. Then at the time of the death of Saul, the same thing is what really prompted David's response in poetry, as well as avenging Saul's death, both of Saul and Jonathan, was that God's people would be scoffed at and mocked by the Philistines. And so he wrote that great line, "Tell it not in Gath." And so David is the type of man who, for whom the glory of God is a central concern. And when he has experienced the successes that he has from chapter 1 through chapter 5 over a period of 7.5 years, and he enjoys shortly a period of relative peace, he then looks around asking himself, what can I do to honor the God who has made all this possible? And his answer is in chapter 6, he's going to bring the Ark of the Covenant, that representation of the presence of God, into Jerusalem. And then in chapter 7, he's going to inquire if maybe he might build God a permanent sanctuary there. He might be the builder of the temple of God. Well, the answer to that's going to be no. But I want you to see in the text itself the direction of David's mind. Having won the victories that he has won, now he's asking, what can I do that I might honor God and give him the glory? I want to say a few things about the ark itself so that we know what we're talking about, because that is the major concern of 2 Samuel chapter 6, the ark of the covenant of God. It's called sometimes that. It's also called the ark of testimony. It was a rectangular box. If I had something to measure with, I think it'd be approximately the size of the lectern. It's 2.5 by 2.5 by 4 feet tall. That may be a little bit taller than 4 feet. 2.5 feet by 4 feet tall, laid out long ways. The top of it was covered with pure gold. That top is called the mercy seat. And then on two ends stood two cherubim who were looking down, gazing upon the mercy seat. It was made of acacia wood. And on the four corners at the bottom of it were rings through which poles were inserted, by which the whole ark would then be transported and carried by the Levites. Very specific instructions were given about the way in which the Ark of the Covenant of God was going to be carried about. It was a receptacle in terms of its function. It was a receptacle for the two tablets of the Decalogue, the pot of manna and Aaron's rod that had been preserved from the time of the Exodus, and the written scrolls of the law of God. It functioned also as the symbol of the divine presence, where God met with his people and where God revealed his will. In Exodus 25, verse 22, God said then of the whole ark and its mercy seat, "And there I will meet with you. And from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which are upon the ark of the testimony, I will speak to you about all that I give you in commandment for the sons of Israel." In terms of what it visually represents, it is God's footstool set before his invisible throne. We worship an invisible God. Well, the mercy seat with its golden top and its cherubim was the footstool of that throne, which then rose up invisibly from that point on up into space, into the space within the temple. So it is the footstool of the invisible throne of God, that place where God rests his feet, that place where God meets with his people. In terms of its historical function, it was the ark that led to Israel across the Jordan River. It was the ark that led the children of Israel around the city of Jericho when the walls came tumbling down. But because of superstition that became attached to it, the people of God lost the ark. In 1 Samuel 4 through 7, we read many months ago of the occasion in which the ark was captured by the Philistines because they treated it without proper respect and so forth. God struck them with tumors. They then placed the ark on a cart and sent it off in the direction of Israel. It then traveled to Beth Shemesh, Israelite town. And there the people of Beth Shemesh dared to look into, gaze upon the ark. And so likewise, we're treating it disrespectfully. We're not giving it the reverence that it was due as the representation of God's dwelling place. And so God struck them dead. And we read of that in 1 Samuel 6, verse 19. It says there that he struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh, 1 Samuel 6, 19, because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. And there was a great number of them that God slaughtered because of this. And the men of Beth Shemesh, it says in verse 20, the men of Beth Shemesh said, "Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? And to whom shall he go up from us?" So the people were terrorized by this point by the ark. And so it remained for 70 years at Kiriath Jearim, where it was finally left. There it remained in the town called Kiriath Jearim. For 70 years it remained unmoved. This location is something like 8 miles west of Jerusalem. It remained unmoved because they were frightened to death of it. They knew what had happened to the Philistines. They knew what had happened to the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh. They knew that it was to have the honored place amongst the people of God. It was to be centrally located and to be the focal point of the worship of the people of God. But for 70 years, they didn't deal with it at all. And so David says, it's been long enough. We need to bring the Ark of the Covenant into the city, into the sanctuary of God, and give it that central place. The aim of doing this, according to the Scottish commentator Blakey, was to bring God into the very midst of the nation and on the choicest and most prominent pedestal. So that's what David is aiming to do as he brings the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. And so let's pick up the story then in 2 Samuel chapter 6. It says there, "Now David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people who were with him to Baali Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name, the very name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim." See, the cherubim are his footstool. He is enthroned above them. His throne rises up from the cherubim who are on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. That's where God's throne is to be. Not down there in the lowlands at Kiriath Jearim, 8 miles out of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the capital. There the temple shall be. There the tabernacle will be temporarily until the temple is built. That is God's throne. That is where the ark must be, is in Jerusalem. And they placed, it says verse 3, they placed the ark of God on a new cart. They're taking care. They know what's happened before, and so they are taking some care. They're going to put it on a new cart, not just some old cart, not the Philistine cart that it had ridden on 70 years before, but they get a new cart for it, that they might bring it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were leading the new cart. So they brought it with the ark of God from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Ahio was walking ahead of the ark. Meanwhile, David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with all kinds of instruments made of fir wood and with lyres and harps, tambourines, castanets, and cymbals. And so this is a great occasion, and it starts out wonderfully, doesn't it? A great festive time, a time in which God is to be honored, a time in which the people of God are rejoicing. They are enthusiastic. They are sincere. They are aiming at the glory of God. Everything is moving ahead wonderfully with great excitement. But their carelessness brings disaster. But when they came, verse 6, to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out toward the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen nearly upset it. The anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down there for his irreverence. And he died there by the ark of God. And David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah, and that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. So David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the ark of the Lord come to me?" And David was unwilling to move the ark of the Lord into the city of David with him. But David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. Thus the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all of his household. Despite the high motives, despite the rejoicing, disaster struck. Why did it happen? Why did God lash out at them as he did? Well, let's first talk about why it didn't happen and see if there are some valuable lessons that we learn from what happened here on this wonderful occasion that turns into a disaster. It didn't happen, number one, because something was wrong with God. I mean, this is what David's reaction really is saying. David is angry. He's angry with God. He's afraid. Verse 8, he's angry. Verse 9, he's afraid. Verse 10, he's unwilling. He's not going to deal with it anymore. David is concluding something's wrong with God. God should not have done that. That's really what David is saying. God overreacted. Or maybe even God should have checked with David first. And found out about how sincere and enthusiastic they all were and how everybody was rejoicing and how God spoiled the whole party. Ruined it by this instantaneous thrashing, lashing out as he did at Uzzah. So he's angry with God. God should not have done what God did. And then he's also fearful. He doesn't want to deal with God at all anymore. God is clearly, as far as David is concerned, one who is very, very sensitive, very hard to please, and frankly, dangerous to be around. You don't know what he's going to do next. You better steer clear of this God, because for the slightest transgression, for the slightest misstep, he may strike you down at any moment and kill you right there on the spot. And so David is angry and David is fearful. And what David is saying is that God is not such a God as David would have him be. At this point, God is not as David would have him be. And we can know with certainty that David is not the first one to draw this kind of conclusion based on something that happened in his life. The way in which David reacts here, getting angry and getting fearful, has been repeated over and over and over again in the lives of the people of God. God is not what we would have him be. The things that he allows to happen, we think he should not have allowed that to happen. If we were God, we would have done differently. You know the story of the two English soldiers overheard talking during World War II, saying, "Well, if I were God, boy, I'd set this straight in a hurry." Well, that's a presumptuous thought. As though God were somehow ruling the universe unwisely. As though God had a poor sense of timing. as though God had gone to sleep and was failing to carry out things that needed to be carried out and needed to be carried out right now. So the things that God permits, those things are disturbing to us. He's not such a God as we would have him be often in the things that he allows to go on and doesn't stop. And then there's the things that he requires of us. I mean, he's such a demanding God, such a holy God. He has this law and all these commandments and all these things that we're supposed to be doing, going to worship, praying, obeying the Ten Commandments, all these things. And so it can seem oppressive at times. He's so demanding. He requires so much of us. And then he holds these threats over our head. The soul that sins, it shall die. How do you like going to bed knowing that? The soul that sins, it shall die. Whoever keeps the whole law and stumbles at one point is guilty of all. The wage of sin is death. Here is God, this holy God. And he's not just holy. It'd be bad enough if he were just holy, but he's holy and he knows everything. Not only does he have this absolute requirement of us of perfect obedience, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, be holy even as I am holy. But then, it's not as though we can get away with anything and he not know about it. He not only is holy, but he knows everything and he has all the power in heaven and earth. So there's all these things that he's allowing to happen that we don't want to happen. And then there's all these things that he requires of us that, frankly, we get weighed down by and we find oppressive at times. And so how do we react to God? We get angry about it. We get angry about the things that he's doing, the things that he's requiring, what he demands of us, what he wants from us. And we get upset with the things that he allows to go on, these tragedies, these disasters, these natural disasters and sicknesses and illnesses and the loss of loved ones and wars and famines and the little children dying and all these things that go on that God could have prevented, he could have stopped, and he didn't. And what do we conclude? God is not the kind of God that we would have him be. And in verse 10, he just gives up. He just says, forget it. As many do, becoming disillusioned, as saying, well, if God is going to do those sorts of things, I just give up on religion. I give up on God. I'm disappointed with God. That whole form of phraseology causes me problems. But there's a book out by that title, Disappointment with God. I mean, there's some enormous presumption in that whole idea of being disappointed with God. But behind disappointment with God is this complaint that God is not what we would have him be when what we want him to be. What should we be doing? What should be our response when we encounter something that is unexpected and unwanted and devastating to us? I think the response that that ought to be characteristic of us is that of faith. What does faith mean in these sorts of particulars? Faith in these situations means this. It means let God be God. God is the sovereign. Let him be God. You don't like what he did? Too bad. Trust him. He's God. And he doesn't have to fit into your box and he doesn't have to meet your expectations. You need to let him be God. And you need to let him instruct you by his word. If you don't like a particular doctrine, a particular attribute, especially, if there's one with which you are uncomfortable, whether it's holiness or his sovereignty or his omniscience or his foreknowledge or whatever it might be, the right response is not to shake your fist at him, not to become fearful, not to become angry, but to submit humbly and bow your head and let God be God. What David needs to be is instructed by this. What David needs to do is repent because of what has happened, as we'll see. But instead, what David does is what so many do. They just give up on it and back off and blame God and become angry with him and fearful and conclude that God is not behaving as he should. He's not conforming to the high standards that we have for him. He has not governed the universe in the way that we would have him govern it. He has not arranged our circumstances in a way that we would have him arrange them. And if he were a loving God and a kind God and a good God and a patient God, he would have done things differently than he did. That's the way we think. That's the way we conclude. And when we do so, we are not allowing God to be God. And not recognizing the distinction between the creature and the creator and the distance between the infinite one and our finite, limited perspectives and outlooks on life. And so as we go on, we find out more clearly why it did happen. We know why it didn't happen. It didn't happen because there was something wrong with God. Why did it happen then? It happened because of disobedience and carelessness. First of all, they disregarded the law of God. The law, Numbers 4:15 and Numbers 7:9, you can check on those later, required that only the Levites move the Ark of the Covenant, that it be carried upon poles that rested upon the shoulders of the Levites, and promised death to anyone who touched it. And so when disaster struck, there should have been no surprise on the basis of it. Before they even began to move the cart, they should have gone back to the Word and been instructed by the Word and then carried out the instruction. But they didn't do that. They got swept up in their enthusiasm, probably assuming like we do that any service rendered should be perfectly acceptable to God, and he ought to be glad to get it. After all, we're trying to do a good thing here. And just because we haven't done it just the way he commanded, after all, we're sincere. We're doing what, we're trying to do our best and trying to serve him. And what God constantly says back is that obedience is better than sacrifice. So, number one, they disregarded the law. Number two, they have a low regard for God's holiness. This carelessness betrays a mentality, seeing this as some kind of a toy. What God wanted and the meaning behind the deaths that occurred amongst the Philistines and the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, the lesson that was meant to be communicated and should have been learned was that of reverence for God as represented by the ark. Is the ark God? No, it's not God. Is the Lord's Supper God? No, but do you reverence the supper? Yes. And if you abuse the table, some of you sleep and some have fallen asleep, says Paul. There's a reverence to be shown for the things of God and the things by which he represents himself. So it was with the ark. This was his representation. It was to be reverenced. It also shows a low regard for the worship of God because the ark was central to his worship. And so his law, which required that he be treated with reverence, should have been strictly obeyed. They should have been carefully listening to the voice of God. And a point that R.C. Sproul made a number of years ago as he was expounding upon this text, and I just recall it a little bit from memory, was, what would have been the alternative to reaching out and keeping the ark from falling over and not touching it? The alternative probably would have been that the ark would have spilled over and fallen into the dirt. And as Sproul pointed out, the fact of the matter is, hard as it may be to swallow, God would prefer that it fall in the dirt and get muddy than it be defiled by the touch of human flesh. Because dirt is not sinful, but your flesh is. And so God was saying something about his holiness. It is better to be in the mud than it is to come in contact with sinful, fallen, wicked human flesh. See, we would conclude just the opposite. We'd conclude we're more clean than dirt. No, you're not even as clean as dirt. I prefer dirt. I prefer mud than that it should be, than that one who was sinful and fallen, the member of the human race, should reach out and touch that representation of my presence among my people. Matthew Henry said of this text, "The memorial of this stroke would be a warning to posterity to take heed of all rashness and irreverence in dealing about holy things." You see, the fact of the matter is, it's in so many things just easier to blame God, isn't it? I mean, the whole tendency of our world, the world that we live in today, is to blame everybody else for our problems. I mean, it either goes in one of two directions, even in secular society, especially in secular society. You got a problem, it's either genetics or environment. It only goes one of two ways, and both of them are deterministic, and both of them are someone else's fault. It's either written into your genes, and so that's why you do what you do. That's why you're addicted to what you're addicted to. That's not why you behave the way you behave. It's just programmed into you, and you're helpless before it. It's all in your genes. It's all whose fault? Who made the genes? Well, you inherited it from your mom and dad, but who made them? Ultimately, the buck passes right to the throne of God, doesn't it? It's his fault. He made me the way I am. He's responsible for my sin. The other, of course, is environment. You are what you are because of all the environmental factors, the things that have shaped you, your mom, your dad, poverty, lack of education. All these things have conspired together to create the monster that you are. They have made you the despicable character that you are. It's because of environmental factors that you have fallen and done and become all that you have become or failed to become. And once again, who's responsible for all of that? Don't we believe in a God of providence? Ultimately, didn't he choose our parents? Isn't he the one who has so ordered events that we experienced all the things that we experienced? Couldn't he have, if you don't believe that, couldn't he have prevented every one of those experiences at one? Couldn't he have redirected things at this point or that point so that you would have had a positive rather than a negative influence? James recognized this tendency within us. When he said in James 1:13, "Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone." Well, then why do we fall into sin, James? Verse 14, "But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust." Sorry, it's your fault. It's my fault. I'm not a puppet. Nobody's making me do what I do. I do what I do because I want to do it. And when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren, says James. Don't be deceived. Don't think of someone else. Don't blame God. Don't blame environment. Don't blame genes. David, don't blame God for this. Don't think there's something wrong with God. Don't say to God, "God, you're not what you should be. You haven't done what you should have done." What David should do is he should repent, and he should carry on according to the law of God and transport the ark in the way that God himself had commanded. The problem with David is David doesn't deal with his sin. He has presumed upon his relationship with God and become careless and disrespectful in the process. Now, this is one of the besetting sins, I think, especially of ministers, but also of Christians who are around the things of God regularly. Familiarity can breed contempt. Contempt for the Lord's table, contempt for his word, contempt for holy things. Familiarity breeds a kind of carelessness, careless attitude about God and his word and his people, his fellowship, his worship. That's when we get into trouble. That's when irreverence creeps in. That's when we begin to take a light-hearted and unholy view of the things of God, and we invite his judgments upon us. Well, down in verse 12, we read in 12 through 19 that David's obedience and carefulness then brings God's blessing. See, David, looking back up at verse 11, he starts to notice that Obed-Edom is being blessed. So he starts to think, well, maybe things aren't so bad, huh? He reevaluates the situation. So verse 12, "Now it was told King David, saying, the Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him on account of the ark of God." And so that obviously triggered a reevaluation process of David in David's mind, that maybe God was not such the ogre that he had made him out to be. Maybe there was more at work there than he at first had recognized. Maybe he shouldn't have become so angry and so fearful. Maybe there was more to it. Verse 13, "And so it was..." Excuse me, the other half of verse 12. "And David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom into the city of David with gladness. And so it was that when the bearers of the ark of the Lord had gone six paces, he sacrificed an ox and a fatling." Now, they just get started, and they take six steps, and David says, to lose the colloquial, "I'm not messing around this time." He stops, He offers a sacrifice, atoning for the sins that they had previously committed. And as far as the procedure that they use, the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles chapter 15, listen to what it said there of this incident. David said, "No one is to carry the ark of God but the Levites, for the Lord chose them to carry the ark of God and to minister to him forever." See, David learned something. Verse 12 of 2 Chronicles 15. He says to the Levites, "Consecrate yourselves, both you and your relatives, that you may bring up the ark of the Lord God of Israel to the place that I have prepared for it. Because you did not carry it at the first, the Lord our God made an outburst on us, for we did not seek him according to the ordinance." So the priests and the Levites consecrated themselves to bring up the ark of the Lord God of Israel. And the sons of the Levites carried the ark of God on their shoulders with the poles thereon, as Moses had commanded according to the word of God. This time, David repents. This time, David offers a sacrifice. And this time, David does it in the way that he was instructed to do it. Verse 14, "And David was dancing before the Lord with all his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod," which is a priestly garment. "And so David and all the house of Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet. And it happened that as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, that Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window, and she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. And so they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent, which David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And when David had finished offering the burnt offerings and the peace offering, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord. Further, he distributed to all the people, to all the multitude of Israel, both men and women, a cake of bread and one of dates and one of raisins to each one. Then all the people departed, each to his house." So this time, having learned, all goes well. And it's a time of great rejoicing, and they're singing, and they're dancing. Yes, they're dancing. Now, what do we make of the fact that they're dancing? Much has been made of it, wrongfully, I believe. It's been used as a justification for liturgical dance, so-called. I would just point out to you that David's dancing is not done in the temple, is not done in a public worship service, and it is not choreographed dance. David and all the people are so excited as they are leading up to the sanctuary. They are jumping around and singing and shouting and carrying on with great enthusiasm. Does it say anything about public worship? Does it imply anything about public worship? No, I don't think it does. This is not a public worship service. This is not going on inside of the temple. Believe me, in the Holy of Holies, they will not be dancing around. So what does that mean for us in terms of our worship? Well, to be a little bit facetious, it means that as you're walking from the parking lot into the chapel or into the sanctuary, you can dance all you want. But once you come into this place of worship, there'll be no dancing. Go ahead, dance all you want in the parking lot. Dance right down Oglethorpe Lane out here as you come into the chapel. Dance all you want, jump up and down, and carry on with as much enthusiasm as you want. That's fine. But as for what it has to say about public worship itself, I don't believe it has anything to say about public worship. And nor do I believe that such dancing went on within the temple or within the tabernacle that preceded the temple. But nevertheless, it was a great occasion. Psalm 47 probably celebrates the ecstasy of the moment as that visible representation of God's enthronement in Israel as king over all of the earth. Not just over Israel, not just over Jerusalem, but his enthronement above the cherubim as king and Lord over all of the earth. What a moment that was. What excitement, what joy, what a thrill it was. That finally God was dwelling in the midst of his people. And not just in the midst of the people, but thereby ruling over the nations of the world. The first step in God getting the glory of which he was worthy. as he begins to draw all peoples to himself, finally consummated in the rule of Christ, who has ascended and sits upon the throne of David in heaven. You know, the wonderful simplicity to life. I try to tell this to the children all the time. I say, look, life is very, very simple. You just do what you're told and everything goes well. Seriously, just do what you're told. Just do what mommy and daddy say. Don't argue about it. Don't fuss about it. Don't backtalk. Don't disobey. If you just do what you're told, life is wonderfully simple and things go right. And this is the lesson. It's a very simple lesson that each one of us needs to learn. David needed to learn. Just do it the way God said it. Just pay careful attention. Listen to his voice. Carry out his instructions. And life will be filled with a matter of great joy and rejoicing. But even when you do it all right, and even when it is such a grand and momentous event as this, not everybody's going to join in. Not in this world. And so you've got the problem of Michal as we conclude the chapter. When David returned to bless his household, Michal, the daughter of Saul, she's so fuming mad that she won't even let him get in the house. You see there? Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said with bitter sarcasm, "How the king of Israel distinguished himself today. He uncovered himself today in the eyes of his servants' maids as one of the foolish ones shamelessly uncovers himself." She's exaggerating, of course, the same way they did about Jesus, that Jesus was a drunkard and a glutton. Was Jesus a drunkard and a glutton? No. Did he drink and eat? Yes. Did David rejoice? Yes. Did he uncover himself? No. But as far as she's concerned, he was completely out of control. And she's bitterly jealous of what he's done. So David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father." What's behind Michal's complaint here? Probably some jealousy about her father, who was the king and who lost his kingdom as he was killed in battle. She probably is spiritually about as alive as the floorboards down here, completely uncomprehending the joy of this moment of God's enthronement in the midst of his people. David says to her, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord over Israel. Therefore, I will celebrate before the Lord. And I will be more lightly esteemed than this, and will be humble in my own eyes. But with the maids of whom you have spoken, with them I will be distinguished." David doesn't mind being humbled. He's not a proud man. He doesn't demand all of the pomp and circumstance of the throne. He doesn't mind humiliation. He thinks it's good, it's right, it's proper. And he'll be more humble than this and do things more humble, more unstatesmanlike when it comes to the service and worship of God. In verse 23, God curses her, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. I think... the way that this is positioned, all of this, you know, the tragedy and then the great rejoicing when finally they do it right in this majestic moment, and then it ends on this sour note. Doesn't it tell us that really you never are going to please everybody? That there's always going to be the wheat and the tares growing up together, one right beside the other? Isn't that the way it's always going to be? You can sow the seed of the word and some are going to receive it with joy, and then they're going to sour and die. You know, only one in four seeds finally springs up and bears fruit. I can remember when I first came to the church here, and we started growing real fast, and I thought everything was just going wonderfully, and I was so shocked first year here to find out people were not happy. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, we just added, you know, like 100 new members a year for several years. And the place was filling up, and the attendance was doubling everywhere you looked, and all kinds of young people, children, all this, everything to be happy about. And people were not happy. And I just, you know, it just baffled me as a young minister, new to the ministry. In fact, I've often said the one thing I've never was prepared for by seminary was for the amount of conflict that you have in the church. Never had any concept of that whatsoever. Completely unprepared for it. Utterly unprepared for it. Tell you the truth. And I remember going to some folks and sitting down and saying, you know, just looking at the whole ministry of the church and saying, what possibly do you have to be unhappy about? Please help me to understand what is happening here that you could possibly be unhappy about. You know, let's just survey the whole life of the church. Let's look at what's happening out there. So go ahead, pinpoint it to me. Describe it for me. What possibly in all of the world do you have to be unhappy about? And I remember just getting blank stares to that question from the people who were the most furiously angry with everything that was going on. They didn't even know what they were angry about. They were just angry. Didn't like all these new people. Didn't like all this energy. Didn't like all that was going on. Something about it just didn't like. Just were unhappy. Just were miserable for the sake of being miserable. And so here's Michael. Michael, surrounded by the people of God in the midst of their excitement and this thrilling moment, really one of the high points of redemptive history. God is enthroned above the cherubim in Jerusalem as he rules over the nations. She is so furious. She doesn't even let Dave get in the door. She runs out and greets him as she sees him approaching. And then begins to lacerate him with her tongue. What does she have to be upset about? Don't know. It's not her. I'll tell you this, though. It's not David's problem. It's her problem. Right? This time, now the other time it was David's problem. David's fault. David blame shifted. That was wrong. It was David's fault then. This time it's not David's fault. This time it's Michael's fault. David did it right. She's still unhappy. And this is a pattern that will be repeated forever in the life of the people of God. There are some people who are just never going to be happy. And the fact of the matter is, that's their problem. But as for God's people, we rejoice that God is upon his throne and that he is enthroned above the cherubim, that the Lord Jesus Christ is the King of kings and Lord of lords, seated at the right hand of the Father. And from thence he shall come to judge the quick and the dead. In the meantime, we're going to serve him and worship him and preach his word and pray Almighty God that it'll bear fruit and multiply throughout the world.